Michael.
Yes.
Oscar is out sick.
On a Friday?
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Here's your soup.
Chicken?
Yes.
With the little stars?
Yes.
Heated to 180 degrees?
Why don't I pour it in your lap and you can tell me?
I don't have to be mean. I'm sick.
Ask me symptoms. I'm on WebMD.
What are your symptoms?
I have the chills. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling nauseous and my head's killing.
Checks out.
We praise the colorectal surgeon, misunderstood and much maligned, slaving away in the heart of darkness, working where the sun don't shine. Respect the colorectal surgeon, it's a calling few would crave. Lift up your hands and join us, let's all do the finger wave.
I think that's quite enough.
Bowser and Blue, tasteful Canadian humor. 521-TALK, star 580, 1-800-580-CFRA. And Dr. Barry Dworkin is back for the Wednesday house call. And every single phone line is available right now. And it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
From CTV News, the federal government said yesterday it intends to put a street drug known as bath salts under the same regulations as cocaine and heroin. The health minister said the government will place the key ingredient in the drug, MDPV, under Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. The move will make possessing, trafficking, importing, and exporting, or manufacturing the drug a criminal offense. This has been linked, of course, to a high-profile criminal case in Miami where it appeared as though a man was hallucinating when he attacked another man with a vicious attack. What do you know about MDPV?
Well, this is known as fake cocaine in the United States, and it is a compound that causes hallucinations. That would explain that sort of behavior. Tremors, increases your reflexes, your joint, your muscles will spasm. Low blood pressure can give you seizures. There's a ton of stuff: cramps, abdominal cramps, vomiting. It's treated in terms of its treatment of overdose. It's treated the same way as you would treat someone who's taking amphetamine or speed as an overdose. So it is not a great thing to be taking.
Do you think it's something that you could become dependent on? Do you think it would have an addictive traits?
I don't know if it has
traits.
I don't have information about whether it has an addictive quality to it. It's more you take it and it can give you. You can have, certainly if you take it every day, you might have withdrawal effects from it. But in terms of an addictive quality, certainly nothing like cocaine in terms of an addictive quality.
Right.
But nevertheless. I'm astounded that they sell this stuff on the internet.
Or the people buy it.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Everybody talks about chemicals in our food or the minuscule amounts of things that are in our food
BPA
supply.
BPA in the water bottle,
right? Which your body breaks down in 3 hours and doesn't do any harm to you in the first place. But people don't want to hear that because it upsets their worldview. But when you have compounds such as this called 5-fluoromethocanthinone, 3,4-methylenedioxypyrovalerone, which is exactly what this compound is, you go, what the heck am I putting into my body?
Right.
You know, these are all chemicals. Yeah. And in this case, people are willingly putting this stuff into their bodies that are causing a true toxic reaction in their body.
That's what's happening to them.
Yeah.
Their reality is totally altered.
It is a neurostimulant. So that's why they're getting hallucinations and seizures. It's causing all kinds of neurons to fire that shouldn't fire.
I mean, we were in Florida, the first day we landed in Florida last week was the day that this hit the news in Miami, this terrible attack. And the authorities in Florida said, you know, we've seen 3 or 4 other incidents just like this where people take this stuff and then they flip out. They become incredibly violent and out of control.
There's no specific dosage. It's not as if you buy this and it says, please take this at one milligram every four hours.
Or
no,
whatever.
They just down 10 grams at the same time.
Yeah. I wonder how long it lasts.
Don't know. That I don't know.
I wonder if there's what the half-life is or anything like that. You know,
if it's like an amphetamine, it would last. Its half-life is going to last, 6-8 hours at least.
Oh. Okay. So that's one case that I want to talk about. There's another one here that I want to bring up as well. Again, from the This is from the Atlantic Canada Bureau, CTV News. A Nova Scotia family is warning others about the dangers of poppy seed tea, a dangerous but easily obtained product which is being blamed for the death of their son. Cole Marchand, cousin of Boston Bruins forward Brad Marchand, died 2 weeks ago from an opium overdose after drinking tea made from a poppy seed pod that he ordered on the internet. The 19-year-old Upper Tantallon man was found by his father in his bed after drinking the tea. He was dead. We are going to counseling for trauma. It's a vision you will never forget. When you get the pod, you take the seeds out of the pod, you grind them up, you add them to hot water, and you make the tea. If you take too much, then your respiratory system starts to break down. You will go into a coma, and you will stop breathing.
Yeah, that's what goodness. Narcotics will do. That is the typical narcotic overdose where it causes what we call respiratory depression. What's interesting about this plant, it's Papaver somniferum, which is the name of the plant. It produces produces opium as a means of its natural defense. You know, here we're talking about, Rob, we talked about chemicals. Now we're talking about natural products, right? Here's a natural plant,
yes,
and it produces opium as its defense against predators to protect itself because it essentially stuns its predators with this
So if
compound.
A predator comes at this
and
plant,
it learns very quickly not to consume it again.
Wow.
And so people are taking this and they're consuming it. And this contains, in this case, for this unfortunate person, he had too much opium, which is a narcotic, and it caused.
So that would be like a heroin overdose.
Yeah, it's almost, this is where heroin is produced from poppies, in Afghanistan, number one crop.
Yeah.
So this is what happens, and people just don't realize. They think, I'm taking a plant, it's a tea, it's nice, it's natural.
Yeah, it's sold as, you know, providing a euphoric experience.
Yeah, well, no kidding, it produces a euphoric experience. It causes you, gives you an addictive euphoric experience.
He ordered this from a website. It was delivered to his home, and the website was based in China.
Yeah.
Just bought it over the internet.
It's
just like buying heroin over the internet, essentially,
What that is. It gives you the high. And the fact that it was able to depress his breathing, it means that he had a he probably likely had a great dose that he took. But there's also a concept for people to understand. There are people that never used narcotics, right? Never taken codeine.
Yeah. Listen to this. The boy texted a picture of the drug, which contains opiates, including morphine and codeine, to his sister days before his death. His sister said, "What's it for?" And he said, "Euphoric opium tea." Carissa said her brother assured her it was safe, no reason to worry. He said, "Yeah, it's safe. It's all natural. It's much safer than Vicodin or OxyContin, and safer than heroin."
This is, unfortunately, he fell for the hype that natural somehow implies safe. There's no difference between any of those things other than potentially the dose itself.
And websites on the internet say it's fine because it's natural.
Yeah. It gives you a natural death, too. That's the problem. And when you have people that are narcotic naive, that is, they have not been exposed to narcotic medications, it takes a lot less to cause an overdose and depress their respiratory system than it does for someone who, for example, is on chronic pain medications, where they're already
on. Maybe a hardened abuser.
Yeah, where their body has adapted. But you have someone who hasn't used that before, a little can cause a lot of harm. And again, natural does not mean safe.
So he would have taken this tea, one assumes, and maybe had a euphoria and laid down. Why would his heart stop? What causes that?
The usual progression is that the drug itself, when taken in great quantities or enough to cause an overdose, is that it suppresses centers in the brain that are responsible for telling you to breathe. That's what's happening. It's literally anesthetizing your brain that way.
My goodness.
And so your breathing slows down. When your breathing slows down, your oxygen levels in your body go down to the point that you end up literally, you stop breathing. When you stop breathing, obviously your heart is going to stop after that. So you're literally suffocating. That's what it's doing to you.
My goodness. 521-TALK, *580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA. All the phone lines are available. If you have a health-related question for Dr. Barry Dworkin, he's here until shortly before 4 o'clock. We'll get to your phone calls next. Dr. Barry Dworkin is with us. It's the Wednesday house call, and let's get right to the phone lines. And Esther.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about poison ivy. If you're going to be in poison ivy and you have no choice, is there anything you can use to prevent the poison ivy from causing such blisters?
There's no way to prevent the blisters if you get the oil on your, the resin on your skin. Ideally, you want to wear clothing that protects your skin from contact.
Right.
And then using gloves to take off your clothing, because the resin is going to be on your clothing. The to give you an idea of how strong the resin is from poison ivy, it was the resin is called urushiol. Urushiol comes from the Japanese word urushi, and that was from the it would describe the condition that people developed after they tried to steal gold statues in Japan. They would put this resin on the statues.
Huh.
And when they did that, their hands turned red, hence the term caught red-handed.
Ah.
and so one, to give you an example of how much of this urushiol it would take to cause a rash on every person in the world, so 7 billion people, it would take 7 grams. A quarter of an ounce of this is enough to cause poison ivy in everybody in the world. That's how potent it is. So that's why there's nothing you can do to put on the skin as a barrier in terms of a cream or a lotion or even a cortisone. It's not going to stop the chemical irritation. It's literally a chemical burn and reaction on the skin. It's extremely corrosive in that way. So you have to wear just clothing and gloves on your hands, and think of it as really.
And when you go to take that clothing off,
And then you have to wash those clothes and make sure that you then disinfect or use something to really clean the washing machine out later, or frankly, that matter, just burn the clothes afterwards and not bother with them. It's especially if you know you're going to be in a patch of poison ivy and you have no choice, you have to be careful. The other interesting thing is for people that have cottages and they're gathering up kindling and other wood to start fires or fireplaces, or even the fireplaces at home or even outside, if you pick up the dead vines from the poison ivy, which can also be lying with it, and then you ignite that, you can end up with extensive internal lung injuries from breathing in the fumes. So you have to be careful that way as well.
Well, our son's a firefighter, and he was just covered with it.
Oh, boy.
And will degreaser take it off the boots and that they wear?
No, you can't use degreaser. It's not going to really it's a resin, right? It's an oil, so it'll stick in, especially if it's a leather boot. It's just going to stick into the leather. You can't really get it out of that. On clothing where you can actually wash through, it might. But again, sometimes it's just safer to say, just get rid of those particular clothes.
Wear
something that you really don't care about losing. Get a pair of old jeans. Just make sure there's no holes in the jeans. Make sure you're wearing good socks, shoes. If you want, coat the shoes with a plastic bag in order to, if you want to preserve the shoes, that kind of thing. But otherwise, it's playing with fire.
Poison.
It's poison, I think. That's exactly what that is.
Back after the news with Dr. Barry Dworkin.
And it's like, some 14-year-old kid skateboarding up to me, talking to me about lung cancer, Hey, man. Notice you're smoking a cigarette, buddy. Can I talk to you about lung cancer? You smell like pot right now. No. Yeah, are you a doctor? Is this what doctors look like? They ride skateboards around, they wear Arcade Fire t-shirts, is that what's happened? Do doctors go see where the wild things are at 1 o'clock in the afternoon?
Back with Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA, 521-TALK, *580, 1-800-580-CFRA. Phone line's available for you right now. We're going to Carp. Helen.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Dr. Dworkin, yep. I was working out last Thursday and felt a pop in my knee. Drove home. Once I got home, I started walking around, and it felt like there was something grinding inside my knee. No swelling or anything. Went to bed, got up the next morning. The grinding was gone, but my knee had blown up. Went to get it x-rayed. The x-ray showed nothing, but the doctor did all kinds of manipulations, said everything felt good, and thought that it was something called patellofemoral
syndrome.
Yes. I was prescribed an anti-inflammatory. I've been taking that, and I've been icing and elevating, so it's been almost a week. What is the likelihood that that's what it is? And if that's what it is, what did I do to cause it?
Well, you said you were running the day.
I was working out.
Working out.
Yes.
I mean, that's usually, it's interesting. This particular condition is based primarily on clinical diagnosis. There's no test that can be done to really prove it.
Okay.
And women are twice as likely as men because of the anatomy of their legs to develop this condition. The problem, though, is that you had a lot of swelling. The whole knee really got swollen.
The inside side and the top, mostly.
Yeah.
But it didn't even look like my knee.
So it was, yeah. Patellofemoral syndrome usually gives you a lot of pain. You don't tend to see a lot of swelling. You might have a little bit, but really you don't see a lot of swelling in the knee.
Okay.
Usually what you typically see with someone who has patellofemoral syndrome, it worsens when you squat or run or prolong sitting or going up and down the stairs.
Yep.
Pain is usually under or around the kneecap, and it's usually achy or sharp. But a lot of times you don't really see a lot of swelling unless there's some other specific damage that you tend to see around the knee. So again, what I would say is that when you're having, if you had that kind of swelling, something was torn or certainly injured within the knee. Knees don't swell.
Like a meniscus, for example?
Meniscus can do that. It wouldn't show up on an x-ray. Okay. Meniscus would, there's different tests you would do to see if in terms of physical examination, different
what,
tests you would do to see.
What kind of tests would you do here?
Well, one of them for meniscal damage is you have a person stand on the leg that's affected, so the leg that's painful, and they stand on one leg, so their other, so say it was your right leg?
Yes.
Okay, so they're standing on their right leg, and they just bend their left leg up to stay off the ground. And then they hold their arms out, and the person who's examining them would hold their arms and then just turn them, rotate them either left or right.
Okay.
And if there's a lot of pain in the knee when you do that, that certainly can tell you you can certainly have a meniscal damage. That's one way to do that. There's other techniques as well.
What about an MRI?
Well, MRI is something you would do if you suspect the tear.
Yeah, because I did have a partial tear. A meniscal tear in my left knee, and they found it with an MRI.
Yeah. So the fact that you had a lot of swelling, I wouldn't say patellofemoral syndrome at first because you have had an acute trauma to the knee.
Okay.
And you have to rule out other damage, whether it's again, x-rays will show you if there's anything wrong with the bone. But
yeah,
it really
and
won't
the
show,
x-rays were clear.
Yeah, but it won't show you what's happening with the ligaments inside. So there are some tests you can do to look at the what we call the cruciate ligaments, which and if there's damage with that, there's a specific finding that you would see. There's the collateral ligaments, which are ligaments which run on either side of the knee from your upper leg to the bottom of your upper leg to the top of your lower leg. So those things can get damaged as well, and so you really need a good evaluation of those tissues.
So following up with a sports medicine doctor is probably a good idea.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, because swelling in there, you have to see. There's likely something that was ruptured or damaged.
Good luck, Helen. Let's go to Absa on line 3. Absa.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Doctor, I was diagnosed with the induratio penis plastica, otherwise known as Peyronie's disease.
Yes.
Quite a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, he was going to cut one side and stick a piece of fat there from my any part of my body.
Right.
And hope that thing will go straight. But then when I looked in the literature, the chances of really curing them was not that good. So, and the doctor had mentioned this, so I let it go. My question is this. I've lost a lot of real estate, almost 40%.
Mm-hmm.
both in length and in the geese, in the width. Now, I don't really care too much because, but the psychologically,
yes.
I'm just curious. How is there any cure for this, or
it's
any protocols that can follow?
There are some medical management procedures that can be done first before any surgery is done. And I'm not sure if they offered that 15 years ago. That might have changed right now. There are medications, for example, called pentoxifilin, which can sometimes help reorganize some of the tissue. And for our listeners, Peyronie's disease is a damage to the tissue, a particular area of tissue in the penis that causes it to curve, and it can be very painful and cause deformities. And so there are some medications that can sometimes help that. And failing those, there are surgical management that can be done. So I don't know how long ago it was that you saw the surgeon, whether this was recent or was it...
Really? No, almost 15 years ago.
Yeah, there likely are some newer approaches to treatment compared to 15 years ago. So
okay.
what I would suggest is it's always easier to start with medical management first before you do surgery. And
okay.
So I would ask your physician to send you to a urologist to be
yes.
able to be able to first determine the severity of the condition and then offer various medical treatments first with a management plan. If the medical management fails, what surgical procedures are available? But I would say it's been 15 years. It's worthwhile to investigate that in order to at least be satisfied that you've done everything you possibly could to correct it.
Kay is up next on line two. Kay.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
First of all, I've got MS, osteoporosis, diabetes, IBS, and a sleep disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got my blood tested. And they said my albumin was 2 and should be between 4 and 6. What is that? And
your blood albumin? Actually, albumin is usually in the 30s, so I don't know if that's the correct number that they gave you. Albumin is a protein that is produced in the liver. It's responsible for keeping fluid in your blood vessels because it literally acts... It acts... The more albumin you have when it's normal, it keeps water from leaking out. And so when, for example, somebody has liver failure where they're not making enough albumin, the fluid doesn't stay in the blood vessels as much. And that's why you see people get a lot of fluid in their abdomen. They get swollen. Their feet swell up because it's lost the capacity to suck that fluid back into your vasculature or your bloodstream. So albumin is sometimes a measure of how well the liver is functioning. It tends to show you some damage. Albumin can also be found in the urine if there's severe kidney damage. But in terms of what they measured with a value of 2, that's usually not the value that I expect when I see an albumin level. So it might be helpful for them to explain to you exactly what it is they were measuring, because that a level of 2 would mean that in terms of albumin level in your blood would be almost impossible. It's actually literally impossible to have.
Okay.
I see. Okay.
So maybe it's a misprint or something.
Well, or I'm not sure if you have the test result in front of you in terms of a printer.
I don't.
So I would ask them to do that, and please call back, you know, if once you get that, if it's another particular value that's low, please call back and I can help you out with that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Good luck,
Kay. Thank
you
very much.
You're very welcome.
I have to say, somebody called. We didn't get to their call.
Yeah.
They hung up. They wanted to know, you can't be immune to poison ivy. Like if you had poison ivy once, you're not going to get it again.
It doesn't
work like that.
It's a chemical irritation. So it's not, you certainly, you get a response from your body that results in histamine release and inflammation, but that's not an immune response in terms of an allergy. It's a response your body has to skin being literally burned, a chemical burn.
Right.
So it's no different than having an acid spill on your skin and getting burned from that.
If you do it again, it's going to burn again.
It's still going to do the same thing. So you can't get immune to that. It's not that kind of compound.
We talked about this years ago. You had a pretty bad case of poison ivy once.
Yeah, it was a residual on a boot or a sock or something like that. And this was in the middle of winter. If you remember,
right.
I went skiing.
Ski boots.
Yeah. So I went skiing, and likely there was something, some residue or something on there from where they were stored, touching other boots. Who knows what it was?
Were they rentals?
No, it was my own boots.
It was your own boot.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I'm going, what the heck is this? And I knew it was poison ivy. You could tell. Literally, you see linear tracks and scratches, and it swells up, and you get blisters. And you go, it's the middle of winter. What's going on
here?
How
did I get poison ivy while I was skiing in Tromla? Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, again, poison ivy. Be very careful. You tend to see it along the side
nasty,
of... Yeah, you usually see it along the side of paths. The ivy grows out where the sun is shining along a path. You don't tend to see it deeper in the forest. They usually line where there's sunshine. So especially on the paths you go up
you
to the Gatineau.
You see it at a specific time of the year, or does it...
Pretty much as soon as things grow in the summer, yeah,
it's out.
There. It's
so
out.
It's probably out there right
it's
now.
It's a vine. Yeah. It tries to take up as much space as possible.
Yeah. You know, I played that clip of Prime Minister King, Mackenzie King... and D-Day, and it's just remarkable, that Normandy invasion and the sacrifice during the Second World War. But what I also think about, because there's a lot of attention now on how we treat mental health and people who come back from conflict zones and whatnot. Boy, those guys, they didn't have any of that.
No, and you talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Oh, you know, you get off those...
makes you wonder how they got through it, you know?
Well, you were mentioning, you know, you watch movies like Saving Private Ryan and the initial sequence where they can't even get off the transports. Yeah. They're shot down right away. They see their friends
and
shot beside them.
The horror of it all, you know? How did they ever get through that, I wonder? You know,
a lot of them just shut down. But then, Rob, you know, a lot of them had problems reintegrating into society, alcoholism, suicides, a lot of stuff you didn't report. People disappeared or they died, but families wouldn't say what happened, right? Because, again, there's a lot of stigma to that. Yeah. So they'd say it was something else that caused them to die. But, I cannot even imagine
But when you think about this, none of those aides were there for those guys when they came back. You know, we didn't.
There was no treatments. There was no medications.
We didn't talk about it, any of that stuff, right?
It's interesting. My wife's father was a psychiatrist in the U.S. Army, and he worked out in the Pacific when they were fighting in the Pacific. And he would be dealing with these situations where literally these poor guys would be right.
Yeah.
They were gone. They had
shut
right down.
Yeah. We've made huge advancements, though, in that.
We've made huge advancements, and it makes a difference. You know, we have, it's not just medications; it's approaches to treatment, cognitive therapies, things to give people tools to learn how to cope with things. Medications help alleviate depressions and anxiety, but certainly don't change the environment around someone.
There's also, as I understand it, there's a certain amount of time where they decompress. You know, they're not taken off the front line and then they're right back at home.
Right.
You know, they go somewhere else for a few weeks
And there's some research into, in Montreal, there's research ongoing onto how to prevent PTSD altogether, where they've had, for example, unfortunately, subway drivers where people jump in front of the subway and the trauma of seeing that happen.
Yeah.
And if they got to them quickly enough, they found that using, in this case, it was a certain kind of beta blocker, reduced the burning in of the memory of that. And so they were able to cope with it a lot better. And so, again, research is ongoing to try to minimize the degree of harm that comes to people with the memories of a severe trauma.
Good to talk to you today. You're back on Sunday?
I'm back on Sunday.
Sunday at 4 with the Sunday House Call and health headlines during Madeley in the Morning, 10 minutes to 7 here on CFRA.